Well, thanks for coming in, Lloyd.
Well, it's my pleasure, Matt.
So many people have failed where you've succeeded, in the sense that you're a successful singer-songwriter, a businessman. I mean, you owned a couple of record labels. What, like three or four record labels?
Four.
Four record labels.
Right.
You owned your own club, the Turntable, in New York City.
Right.
And why do you think you've been so successful business-wise, whereas other people in your same situation have failed?
Well, actually, man, I don't know. Each time I had a hit record, I never looked at it as being something forever. I just saw it as a blessing. And I tried to make the best of that run. And I never saw myself as what they now call themselves superstars. I saw myself as an entertainer, always trying to do a good job for my public. And I tried to keep it moving. You know, I never thought nothing would last forever, because it doesn't. So I guess in terms of my publishing and stuff like that, when I came out of the service, I decided that I wanted to have a piece of that for myself, because while in the service, I learned how to do things a little different than when I was a kid with my first recordings. So I would credit that part of my life of a business person to the Army days. And I guess that's the thing that gave me such a wider vision.
What did you do when you were in the Army? What was your specialty?
Well, I was in special service.
Oh, okay.
I first went over as an infantryman, and then I later, when they discovered I was there, well, let me just tell you what happened. When I went into the service, they had never heard of this stuff that we call rock and roll or rhythm and blues. It was either race music or music. But when I went into service, I went into service because of the power of my music. My music had started to integrate America. And they was wondering what was that I was doing. Of course, Lord and Miss Claudia was my first record. I had heard of Japan, but I'd never heard of Korea and all that other business. So when I was drafted into the service, in order to kind of stop integrating the South, because all the kids wanted to come and hear me or see me. I didn't understand it. I was just a kid. But I found all these things out later, why I was drafted. The draft board even told me that I had to go into service because of the ruckus I was causing with my music. So when I got to Korea, the same thing happened. I was in a Lion Company in Charlie Company near the 38th parallel. When the kids in the service found out that Lloyd Price was in that company, it was crazy. I didn't realize so many people had heard of me and had heard of my music. So they immediately took me out of the Lion Company and put me in special service to organize entertainment, to entertain the troops in Korea.
And you were at it again.
Yeah.
Entertaining again.
Exactly.
I just got to tell you, I can't believe that is why it's said that that's why Elvis was drafted, you know, because he was causing too much of a commotion at that time. But I can't believe that they actually did that to you and that you found out about it, that you know for a fact that that's the reason. I'm blown away by that.
Oh, yeah, the draft board. The lady at the draft board, she told me.
That's something,
she
man.
She said, at that time you had Bilbo in Mississippi. You know, you had Bull Connors in Alabama. You had Russell Long in Louisiana. These was real bad guys.
Oh yeah.
You know, so they just didn't want to hear anything about kids mixing. And what could be more innocent than a bunch of kids, no matter who they are, dancing to music? It was a new beat. They discovered this new backbeat with this 6/8 shuffle.
Mm-hmm.
They'd never done anything like that. Before that, you know, everything was the jitterbug or the pickle, or one of those dances. Well, kids, before 1952 and before Billy Ward and the Dominoes had 60 Minute Man.
Which crossed over.
It crossed, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
This music was really for adults.
Mm-hmm.
And now that was no long time ago. It was adults' music. The kids only danced when the parents wasn't home. We tried to learn how to dance because we had no music. There was nothing for kids.
Right.
So when I recorded Lord and Miss Claudia and slowed the music down where kids can kind of rock to it and came up with their own dances like they're doing today, well, that kind of like shook the nation up a mm-hmm. little bit. And that was like 4 years before Elvis.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, somebody, I don't know if I heard this or if I read this, but somebody said that it was because, well, rock and roll gets a lot of credit in their opinion. as being one of the driving forces behind the civil rights movement of the 60s.
Oh, no question.
Because black kids and white kids actually started integrating for the music. And then when it came time for civil rights, a lot of white people were right there to support the cause because whatever their parents were telling them was this way or that way, they didn't care anymore because they had seen the other side. I mean, when you're closed off and you hear black people are bad, what are you supposed to think, you know? But then all of a sudden, when you realize that's not the truth at all, everything's cool, then, you know what I mean? So when I heard that or read that, I thought that was amazing because imagine if rock and roll hadn't happened. Could the civil rights movement have happened?
Well, Matt, that's one of the paragraphs I have in my book. I absolutely have in my book because music was universal. The kids didn't care what color the music was. All they knew is that they loved the beat.
Right.
And it really, 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 before Martin Luther King or anybody sitting in anywhere. These kids wanted to dance to that music. You know, back then it was skating rings. They would do it in a skating ring wherever it was permitted or permissible. They would skate together on this music. They had the touch. They had the bump. They had to, you know, they had to see that people were people. And what harm could there be in dancing to the same beat? So the old guard didn't want that to happen. They did not want that to happen. And when Elvis came along, he added shaking his leg to it, even though it was out of rhythm, it was out of sync, but he did something different. And that's why they called it black music at the time. Why are you dancing to that black music? But I'd never seen music in any color. I always heard it, you know what I mean?
Right.
And that's the way the kids in this country heard it, and that's how they heard it around the world.
There are plenty of white guys that sing, you know, with soul, and there's plenty of black guys that actually sing pure pop.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean? It's not necessarily a color thing.
No question.
That's on my Harlem show. I end the show by saying, soul, it's not a black thing. It's not a white thing. It's a feeling. And if you got it, pass it on, you know, keep the soul going. But the Rumble in the Jungle, where was the seed planted for that? Because you were a big time part of that, organizing that whole thing. So back to the business, you know, we were talking about business before. What was your involvement?
Well, the Rumble in the Jungle. Muhammad Ali, at that time, Cassius Clay, was a real, real good friend of mine. And I had met him a few years before the Rumble in the Jungle because I had had, Stagger Lee, I'd had Misty, I had I'm Gonna Get Married, Just Because, Questions, Where Were You on My Wedding Day. I had had 11 hits or something before the Rumble in the Jungle. And I also knew Don King. Don was a dear friend of mine, not was, still is. I've known Don practically half of my life. And Don was interested in doing something different when he got out of college. You know what I mean? He had this big nightclub. Well, he built the nightclub in Cleveland so that I could put my big band in his corner tavern. There was, you know, back during that time, there was little small clubs that you go in and play, seated 300 or 400 people. I always traveled with a big band because I wanted to give my audience the same sound they heard on records. I wanted to give them that in person. What you've seen done today, I did almost 50 years ago. I built all my sound equipment. Every instrument I had had a microphone on it or a pickup.
Oh, really?
From the bass on down. Yeah. People always was able to hear my music. You know, it's no reason why I have such longevity because I always tried to do it right. I tried to give the public what they wanted. So when it came to the Rumble in the Jungle, Don had this idea that we should do something with fighters because the fight game at that time was either how could a world crown, like the world championship, be held in New York, Detroit, or California. You have to make it universal.
Right.
So at first, it was going to be here in a country, in America. The trouble was, how would it be feasible? What kind of money would these guys need? And the biggest gate at that time was when the guy that owned the L.A. basketball team, the Lakers, I'm trying to think of his name right now, did the fight with Muhammad Ali and Joe Frazier at the Madison Square Garden for $5 million. They got $2.5 million apiece. Well, how do you get guys to fight overseas? And up come Don King. Don King had done a lot of local stuff in Cleveland. He had done a lot of local stuff. And that whole Ohio area with fights. And we decided that it would be a universal thing. Let's take it to Europe. Couldn't get nobody to take it in Europe. Don was in Paris. He wound up meeting a guy called Manduga Bula, who was an advisor to Mobutu. And Mobutu had just changed the country from the Belgium Congo to Zaire. He needed something exciting and explosive to get the world press to come to Africa to see his new city, Kinshasa, and on and on. That's how the fight wound up down in Zaire. The Rumble in the Jungle was born when Don King met Manduga Bula on a street in Paris, thinking he was somebody he knew.
That's funny.
Isn't that funny?
Now, were you an investor, or were you in charge of the musical side of the whole event?
Well, actually, at that time, this was, I guess, the first biggest event ever in the world besides Woodstock. I was in charge of putting together the show, the filming, and the whole bit of the entertainment specter of that extravaganza. We had planned to have the biggest promotion ever in the history of the world. That was a promise Don had made to Mobutu. And he planned to pull it off by signing up everybody who was anybody. We took everybody who was in Fania Latin All-Stars. We had signed Aretha Franklin, Marvin Gaye, Stevie Wonder. We had the Spinners, who was just red hot at that time.
Oh, yeah.
Sister Sledge, who was just coming aboard, had never made a record at that time. Hugh Masekela, Miriam Makeba, all the people in Africa who were stars. We had everybody who was anybody. We had the whole Woodstock crew and camera, sounding, lighting, to come over and do the first digital filming was all done in Zaire to make the Rumble in the Jungle the biggest event that ever happened in entertainment. But what happened, 6 weeks out of the fight, George Foreman was training with one of his aspiring partners and got his eye cut. So the fight was delayed for 6 weeks. It still was the biggest event that ever happened. We transmitted the first transatlantic film and sound around the world. And the Rumble in the Jungle will go down in history as being one of the great events of all time. But it got screwed up right at the end, but it would have been one of the biggest grossing events of all time. We had booked every event, every venue around the world. We had sold tickets to everywhere around the world. When George got his eye cut, there was no basketball, there was no hockey, there was no soccer in any of these venues around the world on September the 24th. But when we had the fight October the 31st, all the events was going on. So that's why it wound up not making the money that we thought it would make. But it still was a great event. Mm. And that was the event that put Don King on the map.
Oh, yeah.
And the Rumble in the Jungle became will be in this historic component in the books forever.
All
and
right.
My involvement, of course, you asked me about, my involvement was to produce the show.
The music.
The entertainment, yes.
Yeah, okay. Which you did a great job.
Mm-hmm.
All right, it's the early 50s. It's New Orleans. Paint me a picture.
Well, my mother had a little fish fry. She had, on Thursday nights, she built this little room onto the house where she could fry fish and make potato salad and sell beer and soft drinks on the weekend. And inside of that, it was a piano, an old broken down piano and a jukebox. And we kids never had anything to do. Who was on the scene? Professor Longhair was on the scene, Smiley Lewis, Larry Donnell, Paul Gaten and Anna Laurie. Big Joe Turner was hanging out in New Orleans. Ray Charles had just got there to the Dew Drop. So we were teenagers, but we could not go hear all these great people. We just heard about them. So we would try to mimic all these great artists that who was in town or living in New Orleans in my mother's shop on that old piano. We would try to do that. Up the late part of 1951, there was a disc jockey came to town. First black, big, and he was a big guy, disc jockey, named Okie Dokie Smith. And at that time, we was listening to WLAC and from Randy's Mark in Nashville, Tennessee, Big John R. Only time we would hear rock and roll and rhythm and blues music, of course it had no name to it at that time, was that night. and it was like coming from Mars. Hey, we barely hear it. Wynonna Harris and these people. We decided that we would put a band together ourselves, my little brother and me, and try to make that match that same music that we heard on WLAC from Nashville, Tennessee, and Okie Dokie Smith, who had just came to town. Well, here's the hook, Matt. He had one commercial, and it was Maxwell House Coffee. So he had to make up his own rhymes and everything for this Maxwell House Coffee. And the radio station didn't pay these guys. They only got paid by whatever sponsorship they brought in. So he had Lord and Miss Claudie eat mother's homemade pies and drink Maxwell House Coffee. Lordy, Miss Claudie. So, you know, one day I was listening to that. I was said, whoa. I decided to go. Now, he'd on air now maybe 4 or 5 months. We're inside of 1952. And I said, well, you know what? I think I could write that. And I start banging on the piano. Lordy, 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 Miss Claudie. Girl, you. I just made a girl out of it. You know what I mean? And Dave Bartholomew, who at that time was the first black producer in New Orleans. And he had produced a record on a guy called Fats Domino and was called the Fat Man. They called me the Fat Man. Well, that I had heard that kind of melody all my life because we all played what they call an 8-bar blues. We all would stand on the corner. We could take that same melody and sing 1,000 songs to it. But Fats just happened to take it and made Fat Man because he played piano. And it was a smash, super smash. And we tried to do that. But then I was playing Fat Man when Dave Bartholomew came in. I decided to go and play Lord and Miss Claudie to that same 8 bars, that music. And he heard me making up all these words, and I never sung the same line twice. He said, you know what? I like that. Maybe that could be a hit record. Totally, totally new terminology to me, new language. I never heard anything about a hit or record. I didn't know what that was, even though my mother had a jukebox. I used to dance to Louis Jordan, every record that come up, Amos Milburn, Roscoe Gordon. I knew all these people by name because I always loved music. And he's telling me that I could do that. I thought he was joking. So he said, you know what? Play that for me again. I played it for him again, ad-lib. Couldn't remember no words because I didn't know nothing about writing no songs and nothing like that. He said, you know what? I got a guy coming in town. I want you to play that for him. I'm going to bring him out here, and I want him to hear it. The guy's name was Art Root from Specialty Records. Sure enough, 3 weeks pass. He brings Art Root out to my mother, and I played Lord and Miss Claudie for Art Root. And Art Root used a term I never will forget. He said, oh, that could be a smash. And had his wife with him, Lee Roop, and she said, I love it, I love it, I love it. So they said, you know what, we're going to record you. Had no idea what they was talking about. Said, I got to go to Baton Rouge. I'll be up there for maybe a week or two, but when I come back through here, I want you to meet me at Cosmos. I'm going to record you. Okay. I said, okay, and that was it. 2 weeks, maybe 2.5 weeks, Dave Bartholomew calls me up. I want you to meet me at Cosmos. Come on down here right now. I get on the bus, and I goes down to North Rampart Street to Cosmos. And in that studio, it was a little studio, not half big as this, Fats Domino, Dave Bartholomew, Lee Allen, Earl Palmer, Mac Lynn, the greatest musicians, all my heroes that I had heard about. Professor Longhair was even in the studio, but he was not going to play. I didn't know who was going to play. Fats Domino later told me he just had dropped by because he heard Dave was going to have a session. He had no business being there. But to make a long story short, Fats Domino got on the piano, and as you hear that that introduction on Lord and Miss Claude, he was playing that. I said, oh, this guy could really play piano. And I'm standing in the corner. I don't know what to do. I'm just standing there. And Dave Bartholomew came in the studio. Art Roop and Lee Roop is in the booth with Cosmo. He tells me to go over and get on a microphone. So I don't know what he's talking about, a microphone. What is a microphone? So he said, over there, go stand over there in that corner. And he brought this big old mic. Mic was that big, the head on the mic. And he said, just say something. And I said, what you want me to say? And he said, just keep talking. I kept talking. And he said, okay, we got that. And go over and give Fats the key. Now, what key? What is this? What? I don't have no kid. No. Go over and sing the song for him. You know what I mean? I went over and Fats still playing this introduction. So Fats says, come on, sing that thing for me. And I said, Lordy, 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 Miss Claudie. And I sung it down. He said, oh, I got it. He said, okay. So Dave said, you know what? Sing that three times. I thought he was talking about the same thing. So he said, I sung it all. He said, no, you got to change it. And I started, well, I'm going to tell my mama you took my money and you stay out late at night. That was my three subject matters I was going to deal with. Then that Fats played that introduction again. Lee Allen took a solo. I sung it twice in Bye Bye Claudio Darling. Never heard it. There's no playback. Never heard it. That was the end of it. He said, do you have another side? Sing another song. Well, I was thinking about going to the Army. So Fats started playing a boogie woogie. And I just said, well, night before last, the mailman knocked on my door. He said, yeah. Well, night before last, sing. And Fats said, dude, well, I knew how to do 12 bars, you know, in lyrics. So I just kept ad-lipping. Lee Allen took another solo. End of that, never heard anything.
One take on Mailman Blues, too?
One take. Go that ahead. Was the beginning of what they now call rock and roll.
Down the road I'll go.